This is Around and About, focusing on people and events in our community.
Dr. Sylvia Earle has spent a good part of her life underwater. In fact, I think she would say she spent the best parts of her life underwater. Dr. Earle is a world-renowned oceanographer that has the distinction of having gone deeper as a solo diver than any living human. She has also lived in undersea laboratories 9 times over the course of her life and written numerous books cataloging undersea life and mankind's effect on the ocean. Dr. Earle was formerly the lead scientist for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and is currently Explorer-in-Residence for National Geographic. She was one of the lead scientists working on the Valdez oil spill and is actively involved in providing scientific insight on the Gulf of Mexico. She stopped by the studio last week while in town as a guest of the Tennessee Aquarium.
The impact of that great gusher of oil coming from the Gulf of Mexico, a mile down, 5,000 feet below the surface. Well, we don't know at this stage. We may never know exactly, but we do know it's not good news. If you were to write a recipe for health for the Gulf of Mexico, it would not include putting millions of barrels of oil and millions of cubic feet of methane or more than 2 million gallons of toxic dispersants into the Gulf of Mexico. That would definitely not be anywhere on the list of things that are good for the health of the Gulf of Mexico. Yes, oil is a natural fact of life in the Gulf of Mexico. There are natural oil seeps. Methane gas actually bubbles up into the Gulf of Mexico. I personally have seen it. I've been down in a little submarine by myself, a little one-person sub, about 100 miles offshore from the mouth of the Mississippi River, looking for deep corals that are known to live in cold water, deep water, and instead landing in a great growth of methane-loving tube worms that in a deep-sea sense simulate or are very much like a coral reef in that you've got these animals that form a structure that provide home for hundreds of other kinds of animals. But they don't thrive in sunlight the way coral reefs do in the shallow water. In these deep-water systems, deep-water corals and these tube worms, they thrive on methane. That's the source of food. They're bacteria that prosper on this. I could see little bubbles of methane coming up right in the middle of this great clump, this great mass of tube worms, and the wondrous cross-section of life that was dependent on the existence of this hydrocarbon. But it wasn't coming out all at once in a great sweep from a place that was opened up by humans and allowed to flow at a great mass all at once. Little sips of oil, little bits of methane that flow into the Gulf, that has become a part of the natural system, and it's part of the reason for some optimism about what the future might be with this huge spill that is now taking place, that there are organisms that live in the Gulf of Mexico capable of breaking down the oil, capable of utilizing the methane. But when you think about it, a little bit stretched out over a long period of time is one thing. Just like a little bit of chocolate sauce is really tasty, but you could drown in too much chocolate sauce. You can die from too much chocolate sauce. I mean, I can't imagine having too much chocolate, but on the other hand, I suppose I could imagine it, that you could, when slathered with chocolate, you can't breathe, you can't do all the normal things. Well, yeah, that's what's happening with the oil. Too much of what, in a small amount for some creatures, is maybe a good thing, or certainly not a bad thing. But this is over the top. We're going to have beaches that are asphalt. We're going to have marshes that won't recover, at least not anytime soon. When I was the chief scientist at NOAA, I had the challenge of having to explain to the public that our efforts to clean up the Exxon Valdez spill by using steam and hot water to clean the rocks actually did more harm than good, that those places that had been left alone were recovering faster than those places where we tried to help. The use of dispersants makes things look good, but it's not really a good thing. We should stop it. Those are toxins. They make the oil break up into small pieces, and it looks as though it disappears, but it doesn't. It just gets into little tiny droplets that makes it more available to the small creatures that are plankton feeders. They are plankton themselves, in some cases, that engulf not just the oil, but the dispersants. The instructions on Corexit, one of the most popular of the dispersants, really sound like something that if you want to kill something, use corrects it, because don't let it come in touch with your skin, because it will burn your skin. Don't inhale it. You could die. It could break down your blood vessels. Treat, corrects it. The handlers of this substance are warned with great respect and care, because it's not good for you. It's toxic. Well, think about what this does for the fish, or for the whales, or the turtles, or the small planktonic organisms that have no choice. They're swimming in it. It's not something I'd want to put in my bathtub or my swimming pool, but there we are, putting it out there in the ocean with creatures who have no place to escape. So some of our well-intended efforts to make things better may, in fact, be making them worse. That may be a harder problem to recover from than the oil itself. So knowing it and then acting on it is one thing and another. Right now, while I'm sitting here speaking, just thousands of gallons of these toxic materials are being forced into the Gulf of Mexico, right at the source of the spill. I just can't imagine that we're allowing it to continue to flow. And I'm a scientist. I was the chief scientist at NOAA. And I feel that it takes the voice, not just of me, but of people around the country, around the world, saying, what are you doing? What are you thinking? What you need to do is to capture the oil. First of all, find whatever genius means it takes. And they are certainly working hard, both the BP engineers and others who are weighing in with every crafty bit of knowledge that they can to figure out how to stop this gusher. But at the same time, capturing the oil at the source, near where it's coming to the surface. Instead of flying over it with airplanes, forcing it to become dispersed, you should, if anything, find something that will force it to be collected and gathered so that we can recover the oil and not let it get into these great waves underwater, let alone come to shore and affect the coastlines. It's also affecting the blue heart of the Gulf itself, the ocean.
Dr. Earl contends that it is not too late to work together to help heal the planet's ocean resources.
I think we should be upbeat about the future. I mean, the kids, if there are kids listening, if there's a kid inside of any of those who are listening, just feel your power. The knowledge that you on the planet today have, that going back even 10 years ago, let alone 100 years ago, could possibly know. Part of it has been derived because we have burned through the assets, the fossil fuels that have been accumulated over literally hundreds of millions of years, and we're drawing them down in a few decades. But the benefits of that drawdown, of consuming those assets, is the knowledge that we have about where we are, what we can do going forward, finding alternative sources of energy that don't generate carbon dioxide and put us in the fix that we're in now with respect to speeding up global warming, accelerating sea level rise, causing the acidification of the ocean. That is bad news for the ocean, but it's bad news for us as well. Think about attacking the principal generators of the oxygen in the atmosphere. Acidification of the ocean could have that effect. We don't want to shut down our life support system. We want to protect it. But first we have to know what it takes to make this planet work. And now we do know so much more than we knew when I was a kid. We now have that power. Knowledge is the power. And we still have a chance. The ice caps, the icy polar seas have not all melted yet. We still have a chance to turn back from this crisis stage that we're at, and to move from heading into catastrophe into a time when we could stabilize and see that the world inexorably, steadily becomes a better place. That's what my mom always used to say to me. You got to leave the place better than you found it. She said that looking at the disaster that was my bedroom. You know, you're supposed to leave things at least as good as you found it. Maybe, you know, give something back. And we have the power to do that. The power stems from knowledge, knowing what the problem is, then doing something about the problem. But we don't have a lot of time. Maybe another 10 years will put us over the edge with some decisions that we still have open to us. We still have 10% of the sharks, half the coral reefs, about 10% of the tunas and swordfish, and 2% of the oysters in Chesapeake Bay. They're not all gone yet. But if we let them disappear because we are so greedy that we have to eat that last tuna, we still consume orange roughy, even though we know that's not sustainable, then we will have willingly and consciously written our own sentence to a place that isn't going to work for our children and our grandchildren, all those who follow. But we have the choice right now. And I think when people know, they will choose to do the right thing. And that's why I'm an optimist. And that's why I think that this is the best time ever to be alive, not marked with doom and gloom. We couldn't have done this 50 years ago because we didn't know. Now we know. Now we can leave the world a better place.
You can learn more about Dr. Sylvia Earle by following the links on our blog at wutc.org. For Around and About, this is Rabbit.
Around and About is a production of WUTC, with contributions by the staff and volunteers of WUTC.